I'm Fathery.
This is Dave.
And this is Text Trek.
Engage.
Welcome back aboard the Starship Texas for the 271st installment of the Text Trek podcast, the home of Star Trek fandom from deep in the heart of Texas, where we take a deep look at Star Trek, old and new. And tonight, we don't have any new Star Trek to talk about, not until Disco gets here in April, so we're continuing our Star Trek Enterprise Season 1 series of podcasts. We're going to be focusing on episodes 10 through 18, so we're going to be talking everything from Fortunate Son on up to Rogue Planet.
I feel like it's bookended by two of the weaker ones, but there's some really dope stuff in between.
Yeah. So last round was kind of a mixed bag for us, and here I think there's more that I enjoy in this batch than last week.
For sure, for me. I feel like the track record is up, and there's several episodes I liked unexpectedly and hadn't seen in a, you know, like, it's been long enough since I first watched them that there were several I was like, have I seen this? And then I would see a bit or two, and I'd be like, yeah, okay, I remember that. But I honestly think I forgot some of the cool stuff.
Yeah, so, for the most part, Dave saw some of these episodes one time many years ago.
Many moons.
This is the first time I've watched these in 7 years, but I've calculated, I think this is my sixth time. I've seen every episode of Enterprise at least 5 times before now. So,
it's intense.
And I just watched all of these 3 times, so I've seen all these episodes at least 9 times.
For the Enterprise haters, you just described their torture.
I mean, that's true of any TV show.
That's true.
But I'm curious to get into this and see, because Dave and I haven't discussed this, so, you know, I want to see, like, where we overlap, where we differ, and I hope people in the chat watching live weigh in, and anyone listening later, feel free to comment your thoughts. Before we dive into all of it, I want to give a big thank you, though, to the Text Trek Patreon supporters. That's Starfleet, Sohel, Cake is Eternal, Crazy Dutchie, Joanne Robertson, John Dog, Geek Filter, Earl Grey, Trekkie, Quarkspar, Stephanie Durantus, Braxton, Chuck A., and our anonymous supporters. To thank y'all, we like to have a monthly Patreon watch party. If you're watching us live on Friday night, our next one is tomorrow, January 20th, so you're in luck. You can sign up for the Patreon, come in at whatever tier you can help out at, but if you come in as little as $2 a month, that will still get you into the Patreon watch party every month. And we're going to be watching a DS9 episode tomorrow and a Strange New Worlds episode tomorrow. I don't know exactly what we're watching. Robbie might have some opinions, or we might vote, or we might just trust in the shows and see if we randomly select something, randomly draw a number. How good of an episode will it be? I think that's kind of a fun experiment. I trust those shows. Those are two really good shows. So
I'd be interested to try that.
But we'll see what happens tomorrow. Please check that out if you are in the Text Trek Patreon. It's always a fun time to hang out and chat, and, you know, anyone can go off mute and chat with us, and we've had some fun episodes that we've watched in there. I think one of the highlights was when we were watching Star Trek Prodigy, and we had Aaron Welke pop in and join us on an episode that he had written. So I encourage people to take part in those if you're supporting us on Patreon. It's always fun.
Yeah, I feel like we can't generally do better than when we get the showrunner on our show to talk about the show.
Jill's giving me a hard time about it's bumping into the 49ers game. And it's...
Listen, are you a Trekkie or are you not, Jill?
Well, that's the 49ers are like the Starfleet team, right? They're also based in San Francisco.
Oh, okay. So... Yeah, I was like, that seems like a stretch to me, but sure.
Maybe they should be the 47ers.
That, yes.
But, Yeah, I don't really have anything else in as far as news. It's still cool that Discovery is going to premiere here, but we don't know when. Just sometime during the second week of March during South by Southwest. And we'll be talking Disco in April whenever it's up on Paramount Plus and the final season is out. But yeah, Dave,
we can dive in.
Let's go ahead and get started then. What's the first episode out the gate is Fortunate Son, right? So that's
yeah, great CCR song.
Yeah. Interesting name for a ship. That song was like on the radio when they were. I was gonna say when Rick Berman and Brandon Braga were writing this, but surprisingly, this is one of the rare season one episodes not written or not. They don't have like the story credit or anything. But Fortunate Son is actually written by James Duff. Directed by Jordy LaForge himself, LeVar Burton, and the synopsis on it. Enterprise is sent to assist the Fortunate, an Earth freighter that has been attacked by Nausicaan pirates. But the Fortunate may not be as innocent as it seems. So, Dave, why don't you go first? What was your thoughts on Fortunate Son?
So you know, I was happy to see Mayweather kind of get what I felt like was his sort of first serious spotlight in it, which is to say, who's that actor?
Anthony Montgomery,
yes.
Who I champion all the time. I feel like everyone's dismissive of him. And I'm like, that dude had a... I think that dude was very underutilized.
I feel the same way about Harry Kim and some others.
Yeah, but
they put in some good work and, they get their moments. They don't get the sort of the lead stuff always, but they sometimes get an episode. And yeah, I thought he did really good in this as he bonds with and kind of brings out a little bit of the humanity in the sort of vengeful exo of,
yeah,
the,
Matt,
of the Fortunate.
Matt Ryan.
Yes. The extremely memorable name of Matt Ryan. I thought this had an interestingly pretty solid moral quandary of, you know, basically it's about like frontier justice kind of stuff. These guys are, you know, getting regular attacks, regular pirate attacks, and they're defending themselves, and he's, you know, the captain's out of commission and healing up, and so they've got to, you know, he wants to go and actually track down the ship that came after him last time and, you know, send him a message. He wants to blow him up. And they're pretty solidly, I guess, armed for, you know, a freighter. And maybe it's a little bit predictable that it's going to have to happen the way it does, but yeah, they've got a captive Nausicaan, and they're basically beating up, which is like movie and TV kind of torture. You know, you just punch a guy a bunch. And there's also a little subplot though with like Mayweather. He kind of throws some shade his way about like, oh, you left the life. You know, your parents probably didn't really want you to go. They probably just said that so you'd feel better. And so he gets to do some acting and get pissed, and, you know, and also probably, you know, at least it probably stings a little bit because he's like, well, wait, what if there's some truth to it?
Right.
So that's my basic take. I do think it's a slightly lesser outing of these episodes we're talking about. But I did think it was a very solid episode with some stuff I liked.
Yeah.
How about you, Fathery?
I guess I would qualify it as a like it, don't love it, but that's where I would put most of the season one episodes, I think. So I feel like I would just use that too often.
I get that, but I will say this, that like I think, like starting, I think maybe as of just the next episode, I like all of them kind of notably more. So I'll say, you know, that much at least.
But I do always kind of look forward to watching this when I'm rewatching Enterprise, because I like seeing the Nausicaans. I love seeing the design of the freighter ship. I like that it kind of looks like a junky cargo ship, but you see like the Star Trek technology, like it has like nacelles and deflectors, and I like seeing like the Nausicaans, and it was, you know, using the universe. Like, we don't know much about those dudes who stabbed Picard, but
I don't know that we know much about them after this either.
Well, now that we know that, like, they're pirates and that they were a problem in the 22nd century, I mean, that's...
Yeah, I guess that's true. They didn't even... Nothing, like, even that much was mentioned on Picard. They were just, like, a tough guy.
Yeah, but they needed some pirate bad guys in here, so it was a good choice to use the Nausicaans. A good writing choice that Rick Berman and Brandon Braga probably didn't have anything to do with because their names aren't on this one. So that's also, I guess, a bit concerning, and was concerning for me in 2001, watching along in real time. I liked the football at the beginning. Like, we typically don't see American football in Star Trek, I guess because it is such like a United States only thing, and Star Trek
is
more global.
Well, I was going to say so is baseball, but that's not true of baseball.
Yeah, it's not true of baseball. And Star Trek loves baseball, so that kind of makes sense. But yeah, it did make Enterprise seem a bit more grounded and closer to real life and modern day. I thought that it was interesting that they have so many scenes in this episode that's just the Fortunate crew. You know, you typically don't do that in television. A lot of times they would have, like, one of the Enterprise regulars is for some reason they're taken hostage on the Fortunate. Or, you know, for some reason they're, like, they're on the ship with them. And so they would be, like, be on the bridge during, like, the Fortunate versus Nausicaan battle scenes and stuff like that. But they did not do that here. And I think it's a more interesting episode for it that they would have, like, these entire sequences of just these Fortunate people. And it's kind of like, oh, I don't know any of these dudes. I'm just kind of like a fly on the wall, just like watching this, you know.
But yeah, having seen that opening scene with the captain and his first officer, that's who it is, right? Playing football?
Yeah.
Throwing it in zero G, or not zero G, but low gravity maybe. Or no, I guess it is zero G, or just that football arc.
It's lower than normal. They were saying like, oh yeah, we don't keep it like turned all the way up to Earth sea level because right. We like having that, you know, we like being able to throw the football way too long.
Have some fun.
Yeah.
But because that scene kind of grounded them, it's like, what is that, save the cat kind of Hollywood thing? Like if somebody saves a cat, no matter what else, you kind of know they're a basically decent person, you know, if you see it early on. Just a Hollywood adage. So I think the name of a book. But, yeah, we saw these guys playing some football, seeming like pretty two regular good guys. And so I think we have a little bit more investment in this crew because we know they're kind of slightly salt-of-the-earth, normal, blue-collar dudes.
I like the communication relay thing at the beginning when Forrest is talking to Archer and it's a garbled communication and they're saying like, oh, you're gonna have to drop another subspace amplifier soon. And I like that because communication was kind of a thing in the original series and sometimes they would be like so far away it was, you know, they were having to wait on orders and stuff. So that was something that was concerning to me watching Enterprise for the first time in 2001 was would they ever like address that type of stuff. So that's a recurring thing throughout season one and will play a big part in an upcoming episode.
Is this the first time they mention it, Father?
Yeah.
Because okay, and I think there's another point when they were, like, going to, or this was the one they were about to drop it, and then they got the emergency call, right?
Right. And that was another good thing, because if this is the first Warp 5 ship, Earth ship, and they were taking off, going places where you would think no humans had been before, why would they be running into humans? So I like that they had to have them turn around for a little bit. And there's a couple of times in season one and season two when Enterprise is ordered to like turn around back to Earth. And it is kind of convenient because then it kind of helps explain like why they're close to other things later, you know, like why would they be, oh, they kind of had to go out of their way and they were the only ship fast enough to get there. So it totally makes sense.
Father, I'm going to probably mention several times during this podcast or this live stream that, you know how I talked often during Deep Space Nine about them having sort of organic continuity, you know, something would lead into something a few episodes later. And they're already, I can see, doing more of that on this than I expected. That, you know, he dropped a reference to Archer's comet from, what, one or two episodes back?
Yeah, from Breaking the Ice, yeah.
And then this, yeah, the subspace amplifier things, those will recur, you know, later on in the season. So just a cool, both cool examples of, you know, giving a sense that, oh yes, this is that shared world. These episodes aren't so standalone that they don't, you know, inform each other, even if it's not heavily influenced. Oh, you know what? Yeah, I was looking at my notes here and I see that I mentioned enjoying the scale of the Fortunate. You know what else is that the Enterprise doesn't really have a reputation at this point, and I think that's kind of cool.
Yeah, and like and Starfleet still kind of treated like a newer thing when they're like, you know, these guys that's running cargo, like they don't really know what to think of Starfleet. It's something like they haven't interacted with much.
Right, and Ryan, who's, you know, clearly, you know, built up a lot of anger. He maroons like four of their dudes and just leaves them behind in that cargo container.
It was a cool idea, by the way. I like that idea of like you put a hole in a container and it'll slowly depressurize and you trap people in there. And
yeah, it's kind of sneaky.
Yeah,
but you know, half the time or not more than half, much more than half the time, they're like, oh, you know, you're messing with the Enterprise, the flagship of the fleet, and that reputation is absolutely not part of them yet. These freighter dudes are like, F you.
Yeah, that's kind of cool. And these are the guys who, you know, you think they're the ones who they want to leave Earth. They want to go out into space and get rich and like colonize planets and, you know, like make a name for themselves, make like a career for themselves or whatever. And you know, we see like a lot of like, you know, weird libertarian offshoots of humanity throughout the 23rd and 24th century in Star Trek. And so I think these are kind of the fledgling, you know, foundations of that culture kind
and
of
I'm
emerge
sure it's meant
here.
To reflect our own, you know, Old West.
Totally.
And, and that westward expansion.
And you can also kind of parallel that, kind of like the dehumanization that a lot of Western settlers inflicted upon the natives that we genocided off of this land. And you can see a very similar dehumanization. It's odd to say dehumanization when you're talking about an alien, but y'all know what I mean, so don't...
The aliens are very human on Trek, so yes, I know what you mean.
Yeah, like Kirk said, everyone's human.
Father, do you sympathize with them, though, the plight that they're in? Like, they don't have anybody to turn to keep these pirates off. You know, they've got to... What are they going to do? They've got to put, like, a little bit of fear of God into them, it seems like. You know, morals and stuff like have to might fall by the wayside.
My criticism of the episode, I think, comes... I wish that this wasn't actually as Travis-focused. I wish that they would have gave Terra Nova to Travis when he was all worried about, like, the colony. And he was like, yeah, I was like a space boomer. You know, I kind of, like, had respect for, you know, these colonists and the people that were brave enough to go be, like, the first colony and what happened to them. I kind of wish that they had made Terra Nova more of Travis's episode. And then here kind of did more of, like, Archer and Ryan bonding and kind of have Archer. You know, Archer's the one who he wants to break out and be his own man and be independent from the Vulcans. And he has, like, this Vulcan bigotry. And he has, like, all this baggage of, you know, his father. And I think that would actually be a better juxtaposition against what the Matt Ryan character is all on about, and, you know, with his parents and his bigotry to the Nausicaans and his lack of ability to be able to, like, ask for help and ask for support and that strength to show your vulnerability and that strength that you have to have when you do ask your support system for help. And I wish that could have been a kind of a learning experience for Archer and the point where he is in his arc and development instead of Travis. But it ended up being a Travis episode. And I don't like Travis when it's just kind of like the dopey, like, space boomer stuff. Like, I think he's more interesting when he's doing literally anything else, so...
Right. But, you know, I don't know that I agree with you on that. I like the space boomer stuff, even though... Yeah, it kind of makes him a little bit like, it's almost like he's doing a bit, you know, like it feels a little scripted.
Yeah.
But to me, it's what they're talking about is still fairly interesting. I guess I'll have to see more episodes of the kind you're talking about just to see how I warm to it or don't. But obviously they wanted to do a Mayweather episode, so he got the episode. But I kind of like your idea.
And then two quick things. I like that there's a 47 in here. Travis says, try bypassing circuit L47. That might be the first 47 we've hit in Enterprise. And the other thing is that we talk about, like, how good the food. And Doug Drexler, designer of the Enterprise, his late wife, Dorothy Duder, they named the Duderstadt class of Starfleet ship in Picard Season 3 after her. But she was in charge of the food on Star Trek Enterprise. And the steak and potato that Ryan eats in the mess hall, it does look delicious. Every time I watch this episode, I get hungry for a steak and a potato.
And he leaves it. He leaves it, though. He, like, has a few bites, and they kind of get into an argument. Man, I'd take the plate.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
he said they never get food that good on the freighter. Take it, you torturer.
He's too proud. He didn't want to be like a dog begging for scraps off of the Starfleet plate, literally.
You know what he should do? He should stalk off, wait till Mayweather stalks off, and then just kind of sneak back around the corner.
Or he can kidnap their chef like he kidnapped the Nausicaan.
I don't have much more to say on this episode, Fathery, but just looking at my... my own notes, there was, like, one little thing that I wanted to mention Mayweather's anecdote about how the slower warp ships that he grew up on, basically, there is lots of time, so there's lots of sex.
Lots of babies. And you see kids running around playing hide-and-seek on the Fortunate, so that felt realistic.
Yeah, and that's he said, like, that's my origin, too. Yeah. I think they have some neat little bits of lore built into his stories, even if maybe sounds a little scripty at times.
Are you ready to move on to the next episode?
Cold Let's do Front? It.
Okay, so this one written by Stephen Beck and Tim Finch and directed by Tom Paris, Robert Duncan McNeil.
Oh.
Archer is confronted by a member of his crew who claims to be from 900 years in the future and is there to capture a Suliban operative who has boarded Enterprise. So this is our introduction to Daniels, crewman Daniels, or future time cop Daniels, or whatever you want to call him, whatever he is. But we get like another temporal time Cold War, episode, timey-wimey stuff going on here.
This is kind of the first big one since the premiere.
Yeah. And kind of the only one they do that's not a, like, season premiere or season finale. It's normally a thing that they reserve for those going forward. But I always look forward to this one when rewatching, and I especially liked it, like, this last rewatch. I think just kind of trying to watch it more critically and more analytically, I found so much to love in this. And just, I might have mentioned this some in weeks previously, but Brannon Braga, going into Enterprise, had the idea for a temporal Cold War TV show. And I think that could have been just like a modern-day TV show, you know, on, that would have been, like, during, like, the time of, like, 24 and Lost and Battlestar Galactica, but, like, you're basically, like, during this time of Enterprise. I think people would have been, like, really open to that, you know, kind of...
A Trek show or, like, a general science
Just, like, a general show. Science fiction show.
Yeah.
But, you know, that ended up becoming, like, the main future element that UPN wanted in Enterprise. They didn't really want a prequel. They wanted something that would be, like, more futuristic than previous Trek. So they had asked Rick Berman if he would do something, you know, kind of make it more of a sequel type thing. And then Brannon had this idea for Temporal Cold War. But you really see, like, oh, you can do, like, cool Cold War type spy thriller espionage stories with a timey-wimey twist. And I thought that was so cool. Like it's a classic spy thriller idea of, like, these undercover spies that kind of, like, through their actions, they're trying to, like, bait the other one. Like, they're baiting each other. We have, like, Silic right. and Daniels doing that. And they're both, like, undercover on Enterprise. They both reveal themselves to Archer, and he kind of doesn't know who to trust. We as the audience kind of don't know who to trust. We do learn more about Daniels later, I guess we get more about his faction than Silic's, but just within the context of this episode, just kind of having that little bit of mind fuckery, like, I don't, for all we know, I mean, maybe Silic, I mean, this is Star Trek, you know, sometimes the bad guy turns out to not be that bad, you know, so.
Well, also, like, so, what's the guy's name, Daniels?
Yeah.
He opens up almost with a gift, like, he gives him this cool technology, and, like, he offers up some answers, like, at least some basic starter answers. But then, like, he himself admits that, who is it? Is it Silic? Is that what the name? Yeah,
Silic. The Suliban is Silic.
Yeah, that he saved the ship. And then it starts to get muddy and confusing. Like, wait, why did he save it?
Yeah.
And why do we want to hurt the guy who saved the ship? Yeah, Father, I liked it for those same reasons you did. I liked that they were kind of both hitting Archer with so much propaganda, he didn't know what end was up.
And we meet those other people, the pilgrims, you know, they were kind of cool. I like seeing Archer as kind of like the curious explorer, and, you know, he kind of meets, like, these, they're kind of weirdos, like, they're like that ship captain Fradic. I loved him, by the way.
He's good.
The grumpy.
He's, like, grouchy, but not like
yeah.
cruel.
Yeah, he's just... fine. Yeah. He's a grumpy introvert Lyft driver, and he's this is his job. He's at work. He doesn't want to, like, socialize and chit chat, you know? I love that guy.
But, yeah, you know what I liked? I felt like the pilgrim guys were treated with respect. It was nice to see some guys who weren't, like, a cult. They seemed like pretty chill dudes. And
yeah, they're kind of weird, but they're not like harassing. They're not like you know, trying to, like, stop women from getting abortions like the religious freaks here in Texas. So
yeah. I mean, we don't know what they're doing in their downtime, but this was them at their Mecca, and they were. You know, they, what is it, Trip, who kind of underestimates them, and he's like, this is a warp engine, it makes things go.
I love that.
You know, the guy's like, oh, I'm a warp theorist, or something
but
like
that. That's Trip's thing, is he's got to remember that Vulcan lesson, you know, challenge your preconceptions, or they'll challenge you, you know? So he had to get a little reminder there. The pilgrim dudes, though, like I like watching this episode and trying to be like, which one of them is Silic? Like, you know, staring at all their faces, like, watching what they're doing and stuff. That's always fun. And when Daniels, like, pulls out the, what Keiki's Eternal in the comments a second ago called the Super Tricorder and, like, shows Archer, like, all the cool future stuff. That's all, I don't know, for some reason, just, like, the fact that there's cool gadgets like that in Daniels's quarters, that was always a neat idea of, like, oh, they can, like, that end shot when they lock up the room.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
I actually don't know if they really go back to that much. I guess maybe don't tell me. I wasn't, you know, like, but they made it seem like, oh, well, you know, what else is in his quarters? And I was like, oh, that'd be cool if every once in a while there's some new discovery or they figure out something about something in there. If maybe they never go back to it. I guess I don't mind if you say that. But I thought it was a dope ending because it has such a promise to it as they showed that, like, lot going on it. It also reminded me a little bit of the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark when they, you know, close up the big warehouse with all the hidden stuff.
But where Daniels is from, the 31st century, just to keep it in perspective of the Star Trek timeline, that's earlier than Discovery in the 32nd century. So when he has, like, this little gadget that, like, oh, you just put this on your hand and you can, like, walk through walls and stuff like that. Like,
very cool.
That's why I think, like, technology in Discovery, it's hard to do, but they've done, like, a pretty good job of, like, showing, like, the technology level, like, being up on, like, on that high of level. I think it took, like, a few steps back after the burn and stuff, but for the most part, the technology on Disco actually seems like, oh, yeah, this is post, like, year 3000 type stuff.
The programmable it felt matter like it's and stuff a little like that. A little bit magical, you know, even within Trek confines or within their futurism. It feels a little bit magical. You know, Archer walking through walls, beaming anywhere, like, just in and around a ship in Discovery, yeah. That kind of stuff.
The scene of Silik confronting Archer in his quarters, I like that, but it does remind me, like, oh, they took this from Deep Space Nine. You know, that I don't know if you remember, but when Gul Dukat is in Sisko's quarters... in one of their early interactions. And the first thing Sisko does is he calls Ops and he asks, where's the location of Jake Sisko? And Gul Dukat is all offended. He's like, Benjamin, you think I would lay a hand on your son? You think I would ever hurt a child? How dare you think this of me? But it's kind of similar here where Silik is like calling Archer Jonathan. And you got to think like, oh, Silik knows this guy is like some big famous dude. So it would be like us if we walked up to George Washington before he's like the first president, when he's just like some officer in the British Army. You know, he's not even a general yet. And you're just right. Like, hey, George, come here. I got to tell you something, you know?
Right, right. There's an implication of importance in there. You know, by the way, I felt a little bad for Silik in the beginning when he's talking to the shadowy figure.
When he's getting augmentations removed.
Yeah, they're taking some out. And I was like, they wanted him to, like, start this whole, like, you know, civil war or internal dissent among the Klingon Empire. I'm like, that's one dude, man. That's a big job.
So...
You know, that was a lot to put on him.
We should talk about this since Brannon Braga says that it's true. But Brannon Braga claims that Future Guy would have been revealed to be Archer had the show had enough seasons that they would come back. I don't know if that's true, because if you watch, like, the season 4 DVD commentary that came out in 2005, it was actually, it was recorded while they were producing season 4, and they talk about it in there, they're like, yeah, this will probably be the last, you know, temporal Cold War story if we do a season 5. I don't know if we're gonna have any temporal Cold War in there. So it kind of made it sound like they had kind of just, you know, washed their hands of it, or at least like Manny Coto had. But if this was Archer, like, it kind of does make sense he would want Silik to, you know, stop the ship from exploding. And you know, maybe there are reasons why you'd want, like, you know, the Klingon Empire, like, destabilized so that they're not, like, a threat to Earth or something. Like, you can still kind of see how, like, maybe they were thinking it would turn out that this was Archer all along. But who knows if that was really the plan or if I don't know. Maybe we could still, like, retcon that in there. Maybe that story will still be told someday.
Yeah, we can look at some of these things and see if we can figure out reasons why an Archer would do that in the future. Father, I was looking at my notes and I see I made note of Daniels's his kind of wry mysteriousness. So when he's answering some questions, Archer's like, "Are you so you're human?" And he's like, "Mostly." And then he says at some point, or I think this is Trip talking to him later. He says, "Well, it's good to know Earth will still be around in 900 years." And he's like, well, that depends on how you define Earth. I liked him being enigmatic like that. Almost like the Doctor sometimes when he's being kind of frustratingly obtuse.
I don't know what he meant by that, because, you know, we do see Earth in the 31st and 32nd century, and it's still there. But I wonder what's different about it.
Well, that's what they've done, but at the time, you know, maybe he meant that it's like, oh, it was destroyed and then rebuilt, or it's been so heavily...
Spoiler alert, in a few episodes, we'll see 31st century Earth, so it's...
Yeah, I'm sure the dialogue was just given to him to sound mysterious, you know, the idea being that, oh, with our crazy technology, you know, maybe it's been joined with the moon, maybe it's been...
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, like, I don't know, like, I wonder, maybe it was destroyed and they had to, like, buy another one and from a Ferengi and tractor it to our solar system, and we have, like, a new Earth with, like, all continents or something. I don't know.
That'd be kind of cool, if it was something that out there. But as far as, like, just what I could see of it, I just liked it because it was, like, mysterious and made him seem like this guy who, oh man, this guy knows stuff.
And we see the super tricorder tech again in Discovery, in Strange New Worlds, in my favorite Strange New Worlds episode, Tomorrow, Tomorrow, and Tomorrow, when La'an uses it to time travel to the 21st century.
Oh, how very cool.
But, and that's the thing, that Silic was after. He wanted, because that's a cool thing to have, you know, if you have this pad that has all this information, all these future historical events, obviously you'd want to get your hands on that. And so I like the idea of Silic's faction, they can manifest in the past, in the 22nd century, but not, like, fully. They're just sending, like, the little garbled image back.
Right, we found out Daniels is from 900 years, but Silic is from before that.
Right, so Daniels seems to be, like, fully manifested, but when Silic shoots them, you know, it kind of looks like a hologram exploding. Right. They don't really explain that that's what it is, but Daniels does show up in future episodes, so we can conclude it is kind of a... some type of projection technology. So it's just like a more advanced form of whatever Future Guy is using, right?
Right.
So if it was going to be Archer sending his image back in time, that still kind of makes sense. You know, we know that he's from somewhere before the 31st century. Well, you know, anything in Archer's lifetime is going to be before the 31st century, so that would line up.
Yeah, it's interesting. I guess I can't theorize on it too much until I see actually like how it does play out. I can't guess too much about what they might have intended.
The decompression scene when they have that fight, that's neat, but it's always kind of awkward to me. I'm like, is Archer just like walking around in a vacuum right now? Like, But I guess there's like a vacuum, but there's still gravity. It always seems like kind of awkward to. I don't know what it would actually. What would actually happen with the Star Trek technology if you did open up those hangar bay doors like that? And how easy would it be to, like, you know, walk around on the catwalk and get yourself back inside to where there's air or whatever? But I don't know. Maybe it would look like that. It always comes off as like kind of awkward looking. But
yeah, it seemed like they might not have been like completely consistent exactly. Yeah. But
it's still cool.
I get the idea.
I like Silic. How Silic can like just. Jump off into space, and you have like that cool looking nebula that the pilgrims are visiting, and just like the cool just like espionage thing of like destroying the spy gadget. So it's all fun in the end, and I have a great time with this episode. Let's move on to Silent Enemy, written by Andre Bermanis, who was the science consultant on Star Trek in a lot of Berman era Star Trek, and wrote some episodes on Voyager and Enterprise. It was directed by Winrich Kolbe. Enterprise is attacked by an unknown alien starship as Archer orders the crew to install experimental phase cannons. Meanwhile, Sato is ordered to find out what Reed's favorite food is for a birthday dinner. So we have kind of a serious A-plot about, we gotta get our guns working before these aliens kill us. And also, Hoshi, by the way, figure out what Reed wants to eat on his birthday. So two urgent pressing matters.
It is a little odd to have something that light. Which, by the way, just as a quick aside, I really, because I couldn't quite remember this episode, I was like, oh, those have to be Romulans. This is one of those things where they're cheating in some kind of Romulan probe.
Oh my god. Oh my god.
And it's green and it looks like Romulans.
Oh my god. You had the same thought as 2001 Fathery, a high school kid watching this 23 years ago.
I mean, like, I know they cheated, like, you know, we're just a few episodes from, or not a few, but from Ferengi showing up, kind of a little cheat of an early meeting with them.
I'm still disappointed that it's not Romulans. I still feel the heartbreak when I see these CGI weirdos walking around on the ship. I said out loud, I was in, like, the room with my little rat terrier, KK, in my lap, probably, watching this episode, and I said out loud, I said, like, that ain't no Romulan! Like, I was, like, disappointed. I was like, but, Beyond your Romulan suspicions, what else did you think about this one?
This was one of the episodes where it really kind of connected with me that they're starting to show that sort of organic continuity because they actually released the subspace amplifier, I think.
Yeah, the episode opens with them dropping their second one.
Yep.
And then these assholes, you start blowing them up, which is cool because it's like, oh, you're cut off from communication. Yeah. You're like Voyager. You're all alone. You're all on your own. What are you going to do?
Yeah, it's pretty messed up. That's really frustrating too. Like, you're just like, you just set it up and these dudes blow it up. And these guys are almost just like, they're like trolls. They're assholes. They're, you know, first they just show up, they scan them, they pound them a little bit and then just fly off. But then it like gets more and more serious to the point where they're invading, they're like zapping people inside the ship. They're like, they're kind of like gray aliens.
Hanging up spy devices, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, like taunting them almost. And I have to admit, I kind of appreciated, this is one of those kind of, the two-fisted side of Enterprise. I like that they were like, you know, we're going to go home and we're going to arm up, because this is another neat bit of continuity. They're just like, we keep getting outmatched, and I'm getting, you know, and Archer's like, I'm getting pissed about it. And they're like, you know what? We don't got to go back for it. We can do double time on this. And they do it, and they bloody the aliens' noses, metaphorically speaking. Maybe physically or literally too. I don't know. I didn't see their ship, but you know, I thought it was a pretty kind of cool suspense episode that didn't quite pay off as much as I might have liked. And I also the Reed subplot, I think, is had good stuff in it. Seeing his sort of neglectful parents, I think, was like a good insight into his character. That they don't even know what his job is, you know. Oh, he just always ate what we put in front of him. He's very dutiful.
I feel like this would be like if someone tried to call my dad or my sisters and like ask them like anything about me, they'd be. I'm curious. We should do this as an experiment. I think people in the Text Trek audience, you know, I'm looking at like the folks commenting now that are watching live. Like, I think y'all would know me better than my dad and sisters probably with like a lot of stuff. I mean, like,
That's kind of rough. I'm sorry to hear, Father. But what I wanted, I wish that almost like Troy or somebody had been in this episode to say, "Oh, that's really terrible," and let's talk about that. But instead, Hoshi's like, "Oh, I guess I'll ask somebody else what his favorite food is." I'm like, "Well, you just learned something really pretty serious about this dude," and I don't blame, of course, the actress, and I really don't put it on the character. It's a writing slip. They could have leaned more into that.
The scene where Reed thinks Hoshi is hitting on him, Linda Park is really good in that. She's great in that.
More funny scenes in this than I expected.
Linda Park's good at comedy. They should have gave her more comedy.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that. I think because they are sometimes a little reticent to do it. But yeah, she handled it well. And the way that episode, that scene was filmed, it was good.
So I have... This episode I always struggle with, I forgive it for like not being Romulans, even though I think that would have been like so much cooler. But I was hoping, like, going into this episode, like reading the synopsis and watching the little promo they put out a week ahead of time, and the little, it's kind of like today when, you know, they put like little promo images out a few days before the episode comes out. It was like that. And when I'm watching it and I see like the green ship, but I was kind of hoping that it would just be like some Romulans running around with like helmets on. No one gets like a good look at their ears. Like you were saying, Dave, there's ways to cheat and still have it make sense in the original series when they say no one has ever seen a Romulan. But okay, they didn't do that. They wanted to do like the story of like, oh look, there's some ship that they come across, and Archer is all excited to make first contact, and he's about to, except it's like these really scary, very mysterious aliens that are they're just going to attack, and there's no way to kind of communicate or negotiate with them, so we're gonna have to figure out how to hook up our weapons. We left space dock before we had these weapons set up, and okay, we got it, and now we can fight these guys and win the day. And I saw that in the episode Fight or Flight. That was the first episode after Broken Bow. When they figured out how to get their torpedoes to work to fight the people that wanted to make space Viagra out of the human lymph nodes.
Yes.
So it's only in season one, and we're like repeating a basic entire plot beat for beat on episode, what is this, like 12? Silent Enemy? But you know, whatever it is, it's like we haven't even gotten out of season one. And I do think Silent Enemy is a better episode than Fight or Flight, but it just disappoints me to see them do the exact same thing again.
I think I was dazzled by, like, I love the supercharged phasers. They just looked cool as hell.
That was cool, yeah.
And
I guess technically phase cannons are different from phasers.
Oh,
plasma cannons are like the weakest. And then you have phase cannons that are like a little bit better, and then phasers that are even better than that. They're all just like a beam coming out of something.
And Charizard.
That's the hierarchy.
Charizard is at the top of it, I think.
Yeah, that's what they evolve into. That's the best one.
But yeah, and then shuttle pods will eventually become shuttles.
And then runabouts,
yeah. But I thought, like, on the sort of suspense level, you know, creepy aliens, I like the kind of spooky aliens, and I noticed it felt like the music I've been noticing has been more effective than I thought it would be. I'm kind of used to that bland TNG music sometimes. And I felt like they were kind of upping their game in some of these episodes, where the eerie stuff in this was pretty eerie and made the aliens seem that much creepier. So, you know, I was into it, even if, you know, it didn't quite have the... Like you said, it's a repetitive plot, and... there, it is a little weird to juxtapose this. We could be destroyed by these aliens with what's Travis's favorite, Reed's favorite food. I was glad that they got it. You know, they at least figured it out. Jill was, noting that it seems like the writers don't want us to like Reed. And I think they wanted to have a character who's hard to get to know. Like,
I feel like they want us to like Reed too much. I feel like Enterprise gives Reed too much spotlight and too much attention. I'm like, I would much rather see Hoshi or Travis. I think that they're much more interesting people. Like the show just seems like so obsessed with Trip and Reed, and they're just constant. I think those were the characters that Brannon Braga and Rick Berman most liked, and so those are the ones that they were trying to push in everyone's face, and I think it hurt. I think it hurt the show, but. Please continue.
Yeah, no, I don't know that I had much more than that.
We got Natalie from Pensacola mentioned. She didn't want a long distance relationship. So,
oh, you know what? I really liked that. That was I thought a well scripted scene where Trip. What is it like? What's the context of that? Oh, it's because of the subspace amplifier.
Yeah, I got a message saying that they're done.
Right, but like where other people were kind of getting these good bits and pieces. You know what I liked about the way that scene was scripted? Trip didn't bring it up first thing. It's one of those things where he wanted the buffer of a bit of normal conversation, and then he tells Archer, and he's like, oh yeah, by the way, this happened. And, you know, that's kind of, one of those, like, a little bit of a guy thing, or just a suppress your feelings kind of thing. And also, you don't necessarily want to hit something personal when you're just starting to talk to somebody. You need to ease into it a little bit, too. So I thought, I don't know, I just thought that was a neat little bit of scripting for a very short scene, and I felt bad for Trip.
I like that they get to drink beer with the pineapple cake at the end.
Oh,
it's like a really like light beer, like Michelob Ultra, like a very like summer beer, you know, with like a pineapple cake. But if that's all we got on Silent Enemy, let's move on to Dear Doctor, written by Maria Yakometen and Andre Yakometen, directed by James A. Conter. Enterprise assists a culture that has been stricken by a planet-wide plague. Dave, I think of all the season one episodes we get of Star Trek Enterprise, this is the best example of a classic Star Trek moral quandary type story. I know that's a particular favorite subgenre for you in the franchise. What do you think of this one?
My favorite episode of the season so far, along with maybe the Andorian incident, to the point where I've occasionally been like, I've got some friends who know I'm doing this rewatch, and I've occasionally been saying, oh, let me tell you about the little moral quandary in this episode and ask you what you think about it. It's the kind of quandary that could have shown up in any of these series in a way, but I thought was well handled in this one, and I liked the details of it. It's easy to see bits and pieces that are relevant to us. You can see elements of Native American reservations in America in the story. And, they use the analogy that this planet has like two sort of humanoid species. And they say, oh, it'd be like if Neanderthals hadn't died out. And, we had both humans, modern humans and Neanderthals running around. I'm like, oh, that's, again, something we could relate to. It's like, had that happened, and the Neanderthals were kind of second class citizens, would it be cool to, if they were immune to this thing, to help out the humans? I think it's a really cool plot and well handled. Good, because Dr. Phlox is a good entry point for that. It, kind of unusual too, because he's not like this just overblown with empathy. In fact, he's like, oh, these humans are so empathetic. They're sure give you the shirt off their back, but he's like. At first, he kind of is a little aloof about it, as he often is, kind of seems to be, and, some of the stuff doesn't seem to make a big impression on him.
Well, I'm going to key off of that a little bit and talk about Dr. Phlox. I do consider him the best character on Star Trek Enterprise. And I love getting, a Phlox-centric episode here. I love the framing device of his letters to Dr. Lucas kind of being used as kind of like the log entry. I know Archer has log entries in this episode also, but just having that as kind of Phlox's narration was a cool way to get in his head. Because, yeah, he's telling Dr. Lucas things he wouldn't really talk to anyone on the ship about. So they gave him a BFF to open up to. You mentioned that, this is kind of a moral quandary story they could have done in any Star Trek show, but I want to critique that just a little bit and say that this is actually unique to Enterprise. Enterprise, because it's something that you would only do pre-Prime Directive. You know, it's most Star Trek shows, they'd be like, oh, we're not going to interact with these people at all, you know?
Right.
Oh, we'll take this guy back to his homeworld and then, like, erase his mind so we don't contaminate his culture. I know it's, like, a little different if kind of, like, that culture is kind of, like, already dealing with warp-capable people. They do mention the Ferengi in this episode, by the way, so a little foreshadowing.
I really like the bit where T'Pol says, hey, even for the Vulcans who, you know, there's clearly a proto, you know, a version of the Prime Directive in this. She's like, even we would allow some leeway on this. These guys have interacted with warp-capable species. They're seeking them. So, yeah, that was a neat entry point that was kind of unusual.
The actual, like, moral quandary for, you know, people don't remember, but the idea of, like, these a dominant species on a planet that's kind of like the equivalent of, you know, real life 21st century Earth as far as, like, development, but they're being wiped out by a plague, and it turns out, oh, it's actually genetic, and they're all gonna die, and but this other species, this kind of subspecies, the mink, they're not compatible, but, you know, they're kind of treated as, like, you know, kind of like these primitive servants, but they're going to evolve into the dominant species. If the Valakians die out, you know, the dominant species, the Valakians die out, that would, I guess, like, kind of clear a lane for the mink to inherit the planet.
The mink shall inherit the Earth.
What would you do, Dave? Would you cure the Valakians, or would you let them fend for themselves and let evolution decide?
Pretty serious question. That'd be a fun class if they ever did this, and probably having college courses, like the philosophy, you know, the morality of Star Trek, and not just like the Prime Directive and stuff like that, but that this is related to it, but just take these specific things and have the class play it out like they would a trolley problem, like in a philosophy class. Archer at first is like upset that Phlox was considering holding back the information that he's got a cure. Yeah. He's like, you know, we have something, we can help them. How can you possibly, you know, not help? But yes, everything's more complicated. It's like, it is clear they treat the other, you know, species as second-class citizens, that they're kind of controlling and manipulative about them, not overtly. They make it a blurry enough that they're not overtly cruel to them, and they give them basic needs, but are, like, kind of keeping them back. There's just no other way to put it. I think they maybe made the right decision, but it's wild to imagine. Because they also do, there's a little bit of a, well, we can give you this stuff that helps you treat the disease. And if somebody's got it, it'll, like, add 10 years onto their life. And so that's, I mean, that's pretty notable. That is not nothing. But they straight up just, like, if that guy were to say, do you have a cure? I don't know if he ever put it that way, you know, the president of...
The Valakian doctor?
Yeah. Did they actually ever just straight lie to him?
No. Say, nope. But, I mean, like, those guys, like, they ask for warp drive, they ask, like, they're like, oh, well, if you can't give us a cure, like, what can you give us? And so I think they knew they were being, like, withheld from. But that's interesting, right. Dave. I would have made the opposite choice. I would have been fully transparent. I would have showed them, your genes are fucked. You're all going to go extinct. I can fix it for you, but I'm concerned about this other species on your planet. So in order for me to cure you, you're going to have to... You know, you're going to have to, like, learn to coexist with them. So you're
offering the conditional response. I like that as an idea. I don't know if it's in this episode or.
I feel like that would be the response. If I was playing Star Trek Resurgence, that would be the answer I would want to select on the on the game menu, but it wouldn't be there. So I would just pick whatever to give it to the. Because I wouldn't, like, look at, like, a Valakian family and be like, oh, that sick child in the hospital bed. Like, I can cure that kid, but I'm not going to because of some hypothetical people that might exist in a few thousand years. You know, to me, like, that's kind of like telling, like, a pregnant mother, like, oh, you're going to have to, like, you know, carry this pregnancy, even though it's going to doom you, but because of, like, this hypothetical person that might be born.
So Star Trek will fairly often simplify things into sort of binary choice. Even a complex issue will sometimes get put that way because it's just more dramatic. Like, that's the simple reason that they did it. And like, sometimes easier to explain. Yeah. You don't, the TNG way might be a little bit more to debate it at a, you know, in a ready room. But one of the things I really liked in this episode was when Archer confesses to T'Pol, he's like, I'm starting to have a little bit of sympathy for how the Vulcans were.
I never thought I'd say this, but I'm beginning to understand how the Vulcans felt.
Yep. Because here's the thing, Father, had they done what you're talking about, well, then I think it's like, well, then Archer, you can't just say, you know, say that and then fly off into space. You have to enforce it then, and you have to make sure it's going through. So you have to begin extended diplomatic talks between Starfleet and...
Yeah, I don't think they should have wrote that. I'm just saying that was just in our thought experiment. That would be my personal choice.
Sure.
I think that's what they should have done in the episode. I don't think that's what TV writer should not have written that.
But I think that's kind of how, you know, Archer at least had, you know, some notion of that, like, well, we can have these sort of long, you know, thing, you know, interaction, you know, that we just start and, you know, we probably begin decades of negotiation and back and forth thing in there, which I wouldn't mind, you know, like, I wouldn't mind seeing Trek do some things like that. You know, we have second contact.
That was Deep Space Nine, you know, that was kind of the story of that show.
And Lower Decks has the second contact teams that would be setting up the follow-through on that. I really like this. I do like, you know, I like an episode sometimes, even if there's the binary decision is one that's a little difficult or very difficult and you might have some struggle with it. Tuvix, famous example. Mm-hmm. And I really like that episode, too.
This is the Tuvix of Enterprise.
It is. I thought Archer was just going to straight do it, so when he tells... Phlox, he's like, oh, I've been turning this over in my head all night, and he's like, I am reluctantly going to do what you said.
I kind of wish that they had gone with the original ending that the writers intended for this episode. I don't know if you know about this, but they actually...
I read about it, so okay. go ahead and say it.
They wanted Phlox to discover the cure and then withhold it from Archer, and I kind of liked that more because it's more dramatic. And if they were doing this today, this is what, like, the network would want. You know, the way that TV is written now, people want, like, the big shocking moments. They want the drama. They want, like, the next, like, red wedding event that everyone will be talking about, like, sure. This big episode. But back then, in 2001, or we might be in 2002 by this point, you know, they want shows that are a product, that's a brand. You see Star Trek Enterprise on the cover of TV Guide, and you know what that show is about. And so, you know, they thought it was important in order to, I guess, to maintain whatever brand or image they wanted of the show. They're like, oh, our captain can't be, you know, some dumb. They're like, he doesn't even know if the doctor has a cure or not. He's gonna be, like, the guy in charge making all the choices. And, you know, the buck stops with him, and, you know, they wanted more kind of like that strong man in control type image for Archer. So they had them change it. But I like that idea because, you know, Phlox is a Denobulan, and they might have, like, a different morality, and he's not in Starfleet, and he can, you know, he might make different choices, but I don't know. I kind of think Archer's kind of too, I think he's kind of too cruel to the Valakians in the end, but I feel sorry for him. I wish he hadn't been burdened with this choice. I don't want, like, any civilian population to suffer.
You mentioned his Denobulan possible morality, and I wanted to bring it up because I really like the subplot of him connecting with Hoshi over his language.
Oh yeah, that was fun when they have some Denobulan language scenes.
Yeah, and he's, you know, it's a little gentle chiding, and but they get close. And then, what is it? I liked T'Pol being somewhat forced, the way dentists always ask you dumb questions, but to when Phlox is messing with her teeth, and he's like, oh, what is this thing called romance? How do you go about that? And, like, should I return Ensign Cutler? Crewman Cutler?
Crewman Cutler, yeah.
Should I return her advances or not? I liked her character, too. There was just lots and lots of stuff in this episode to like.
Yeah, I like the little flirtation with Phlox, and we see more of her. She shows up one more time. I think she's only in three episodes total.
It's too bad. I'd like her as a recurring supporting character.
Yeah, and unfortunately, the actress passed away pretty young, like, while Enterprise was still on the air. So,
that's brutal.
I think, like, during, like, season four, but they kind of, like, stopped using her before then anyways. I don't know if she ever would have shown up again, but, she was, like, they mentioned her in, like, season three. So she's still on Enterprise.
Okay. They had some really good interactions.
I agree.
Like, a few where she calls out Phlox's, like, his indifference. She's like, she's like, oh, you don't care about that? And he's like, should I? You know, in that very Phloxian way. And then he also, like, it brought out that he's has a polyamorous marriage.
Technically, it'd be polygamous.
Oh, polygamous, yeah. What is it? Three wives and two husbands, I think?
Three wives, and each wife has three husbands. They have him and then two others.
That's a pretty intense relationship. But yes, it feels progressive for the early 2000s to even be speaking about that, even though... it's done through an alien, not like a human, which would be a little more shocking, I'm sure, to the audience. But, yeah, just one of the many little details in the episode that I thought, oh, that's neat. Oh, that's cool. Father, do you ever find like that Phlox seems too detached? That he wasn't worried? Like, early on, wasn't he himself not that worried about the interaction between the two species on him? Did Cutler push him to suddenly make that judgment?
She was the one who was like, who was like, well, that's really weird. And he was like, well, you know, it's their culture.
Right. But then by the end of the episode, he is straight up. He was like, maybe not going to tell the captain. Because he felt that, I guess what he discovered and what, and, you know, somewhere between Cutler's words to him, criticizing him, and his discovery that the sort of oppressed species was going to become ascendant, he, I guess, you know, got a viewpoint on it, which he didn't really have before.
Yeah. But I don't know, I enjoy Phlox, and I like that he's not Starfleet, because, you know, he could, it's like the lesson of Deep Space Nine, you know, it's like, oh yeah, Quark can do all kinds of messed up stuff, because he's, or Kira, or, you know, who, like a bunch of people, Odo, like a lot of people on that show are not Starfleet, so if I was ever making a Star Trek show, I would want to have, you know, non-Starfleet people on the ship, or, you know, stationed there also.
For sure, for sure, it always lets the rules get bent.
Yeah. But yeah, I don't have anything else on Dear Doctor.
Father, I was going to mention just one real quick thing about that, sure. One, which is that, so that Hoshi does a fair amount of translating and stuff in it. I know the reason that the Universal Translator exists as a plot device is it just translating in general would be kind of boring and like doesn't really add to a scene. But I think they, at least in this first season, I'm sure they start doing it less. But I think they do a pretty good job where anytime she is translating, there's something that she's revealing about the aliens or someone's motivations or something like that when she's doing it. And so, like, I just, you know, I compliment the writers on giving a good, you know, some cool stuff for a linguist to do.
Well, let's move on to Sleeping Dogs, written by Fred Decker, directed by Les Lando. Well, exploring a gas giant, Enterprise finds the wreck of a Klingon scout vessel sinking into the atmosphere. So this is our, I guess, we saw the Klingons a little bit at Unexpected, but this is the first kind of like true Klingon episode since Broken Bow. And I guess kind of like the first true like Klingon-centric, you know, Enterprise episode, kind of exploring these space Viking Klingons of the 22nd century. But it's another, like, I like it, I don't love it. You know, there's nothing too remarkable in this episode, other than, I guess, it's kind of being the first Enterprise Klingon episode. But it's another one I look forward to. I like seeing the Raptor-class scout ship. Cool. It's, yeah, a lot more than, like, the weird-ass Katinga that doesn't make sense for the 22nd century. I like the siren calls, you know, when Travis is like, oh, yeah, these used to scare me as a kid. Whenever we'd pass by a gas giant, my dad would play these on the speakers, you know, do cool space boomer stuff. Like we were saying, like, they should do more of, like, Travis has, like, all these kind of cool, like, experiences that, mm-hmm. that he gets to share with everyone else like that. And I like, I guess, Archer kind of, oh, he learns to be a little bit more of a Starfleet captain and gets, like, a little bit of a better handle on that diplomacy with Klingon. Sometimes you gotta be tough back to them. And, you know, when he's like, I'll blast you back down there to where I found you. And that Klingon captain, by the way, played by, Von Armstrong. So it was, he got to like talk shit to his boss. Basically it's Admiral Forrest as a Klingon.
Oh, right. Oh, that's wild. You know what? It occurred to me that when Archer, you know, I do like a take charge kind of captain, that there's a little bit of both Picard and Kirk in him. The Picard in the sense that he did his homework and studied the Klingon from the Vulcan database. And then Kirk, because, you know, he's doing some bluffing, he's pushing buttons based on Klingon psychology. And so I thought that was a neat little touch. I agree with you that this episode is, you know, a little bit lesser one, still solid, you know, suspenseful.
Yeah, solid.
Outing.
There's nothing bad in it, in my opinion. It just
no.
A bit of that blandness, a bit Enterprise season one blandness.
I'd agree with that. I think the descending thing. I read that this was based on a, at least inspired by an incident with a sunken Russian sub. I think.
Oh yeah.
Did it have a completely tragic ending? Like, did all the sailors die of lack of air?
Yeah, I think it was like in the late 90s. But yeah, like they wouldn't let anyone. Something like they wouldn't that. Let any other ships
assist.
Yeah,
and so they imagined, you know, well, you know, what could they do in Trek's time? You know, what could a crew like that maybe accomplish?
This is my first time watching this after Star Trek Discovery, so it's kind of cool to. Just what we learn about the Klingons in Discovery kind of factor that in. But we see them as, like, those raiding parties. You know, like, Michael Burnham talked, you know, content warning for, you know, watch out. But when Michael Burnham describes, you know, like being like hiding in a cabinet and like listening to someone being assaulted, we thought it was her mom, but turns out like her mom was the Red Angel in the time suit. So, spoilers for Discovery. Sorry, but those Klingon raiders are pretty bad though. Like there's you know, those raiding parties. So I kind of side with T'Pol a little bit when she's like, these dudes will want to die. Let's just like let them die in this gas giant. It's like, oh yeah, like let's not like have these people just like going around just, you know, pillaging the spaceways.
Well, you know, in the first in Broken Bow, that's what, you know, the Vulcans wanted to do then.
Yeah, pull the plug on them.
Yeah, they're pretty quick to take that choice. It's kind of the antithesis of, you know, usual Trek philosophy, which is you always try and make friends with your enemies. You always try and help somebody who's dying.
Yeah, no, of course.
And you sometimes will do things that they don't want to do because you know better than them, which is why, even though it was a kind of sucky episode, I did appreciate that, like, T'Pol made sure that Archer knew you cannot relocate these people in the caves against their will. That they were at least starting to
In Terra Nova. You're talking about in Terra Nova.
Terra Nova, yeah. You know, an aspect of a mediocre episode.
I thought you liked Terra Nova. I thought we liked that one.
I liked it, I think, more than most people.
I like it more than most people, so I thought it was kind of cool that we agreed, but...
Yeah, in my case, particularly because it's a clear-cut win, and the crew had been struggling so much, which is why I'm glad that, you know, they got their phase cannons up and rolling in this one, and...
It is fun to see Archer is like, he's more... both confident and competent at the end when he's able to stand his ground and talk and, you know, talk back to the talk tough to the Klingon, but he's able to like back it up when he's like, I will blast you back down there where I found you. And the stuff with Reed and Hoshi and T'Pol being the away team that goes on to the I thought that was like a cool pairing, because they don't really have a lot of, like, you know, like friendship chemistry, but they just seeing them like work together, it's like, oh, they really do feel like a crew. And T'Pol feels like she's gelled and become, you know, part of the crew, and she's even kind of like joking around a bit, but still doing it in a very Vulcan way when she's like, you know, perhaps we should leave our helmets on at the bad smell when they get on the ship. Or then at the end, you know, she plays along when they want to stay in the sonic decon shower and in the decon chamber, when she tells Phlox, like, maybe you should run those tests again, you know, we want to be sure. So, and of course we have to hit our, like, you know, Enterprise sexy moment quota, so and show some, you know, people in their underwear.
What I liked about this one was that it was almost like being a little meta, like it was acknowledging that it's a little hokey and kind of goofy by saying, oh, and you know what else? It's they like it, you know, it's actually comfortable. It's like a spa, you know, sauna kind of thing. And, you know, they might, you know, get the Vulcan to lie for them so that they can stay in it longer. I got a laugh out of that one. But yeah, they had to, when they're over on the Klingon ship, they have to do a lot of work. There's exploration, there's translation involved. They've got to figure out how to make Klingon systems work.
T'Pol and Hoshi do have that bonding moment of like the, when she helps her cancel out some of her emotions that were overwhelming.
It's really good. It, you know, things like that, when I get to a scene like that, it makes me like, you know, an episode better, you know, than maybe some of the staging in it was.
I don't have anything else, but what? Let me ask you, what do you think of our Klingon officer, Bukha, or whatever her name was? What do you think of her?
You know, I don't have like a strong opinion, but I think there was something that felt slightly off to me, and I can't quite put my finger on what it was. But she, I didn't feel like she made a real strong impression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's just kind of a generic seeming.
Yeah, you know, it was the, you know.
They showed her some Duras sister episodes to just do this, and they didn't really, like, I mean, they didn't give her, like, anything, you know, additional material-wise, so, you know, nothing on the actor, but that's all I got, though, on Sleeping Dogs.
Oh, this had a bit in it that also made me laugh, and I wanted to mention it. It's when he's just, Archer's just about to talk to her, and Trip says, he kind of gives his little cheeky support where he's like, hey, just remember, Captain, you know, if they sense weakness, they might kill you and replace you. And he gives him like a little fist pump, like, just looking out for you, buddy. Very expertly delivered by Connor Trinneer. And made me laugh.
Well, we get some Captain Trip, so that's kind of fun. Oh, yeah? We get more Cap... Or no, I'm sorry, I'm thinking of the next episode, Shadows of Pajum, where he's in command.
He gets riled up when he's in command. I'm actually a little anxious when he's in command. I was like, calm down, bro.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about Shadows of Pajim, written by Rick Berman and Brandon Braga. Like, damn it. You can't get away from them. Oh, this one's not bad, though. Directed by David Livingston. Archer and T'Pol are taken prisoner during an away mission on a war-torn planet in the Corridon system. That's weird. Is this on the war-torn planet Corridon? You know, why say planet in the Corridon system? But Corridon system from Journey to Babel from the original series. So,
oh, okay.
And we see these people, the Corridonites, they kind of have like the cracky face, but we see them show up in Star Trek Discovery Season 3. So I like this episode okay, I guess. Yes, it's kind of like okay to me. I love seeing the Andorians again, though, and I love, like, some of the political stuff going on between, like, the Vulcans and Corridon, and I kind of wish we could explore more of that.
There's all this proxy stuff going on where it's suggested that the, I mean, we should maybe say a little bit more about the plot in a second, but essentially the sort of ruling class on this planet has Vulcan support, and, you know, Archer and T'Pol get kidnapped by sort of the rebel faction, which has Andorian support, so it's clear that there's kind of some proxy war mm-hmm. stuff going on, which was as a sudden turn towards sophistication that felt a little out of place in an episode that also has I'm tied up and I have to put my face in your boobs scenes.
We should also say that because when they were producing Star Trek Enterprise, they were shooting the episode Civilization on September 11th, 2001, which was the last episode we discussed last week. So this batch of episodes and everything forward in Enterprise was shot after 9/11, and the word terrorism will start to get mentioned a lot in Star Trek Enterprise. You know, it was a hot button topic at the time, and we see a lot of attempts at allegory with that in Enterprise throughout, I guess, all four seasons, really. But I do like here, I side with the Vulcans, you know, they're on the side of the downtrodden, as Shran put it. But yeah, we kind of see the...
Did you say you side with the Vulcans?
I'm sorry, I side with the Andorians, with what, like, when Shran is like, yeah, we're down with, you know, these downtrodden people here, this rebel group, but, you know, they're kind of crazy, they're never going to give your people back, so you're going to need us to...
yeah, it's funny, he says that, and then they go and they, like, attack him.
Yeah, that is weird. That's where I think, like, the episode, like, kind of... Some stuff in it I really wish had like a bit more thought, or almost like they had like a bit more time to show things. Like, they talk about like these big shipyards of Corridon, but they never show that stuff. Yeah. We only see like the little shanty town when Trip's like, I guess not everyone can live in Emerald City. It's like, well, we didn't even see Emerald City, so
right.
But thanks for establishing that. I guess you got to see it. But
they had the dialogue do the heavy lifting in that one. Let's see. I'm trying to remember. Why were they going down to the planet in the first place?
The Chancellor lady, Kaliv, invited them. They were just passing by. Archer was passing by, and they were like, "Oh yeah, you can come visit. Look at our shipyards and stuff."
You know what? Is this the one where Archer kind of trolls Trip in the beginning?
Yeah.
Because he knows that like That's Trip fun. Would want to go down
yeah,
there
he's
and like
teasing
take photos,
him, and he's like, oh, "I guess I'll take T'Pol and not you." And then he's finally like, "Yeah, of course I'll bring you along." You know?
Yeah,
And Trip's the photographer. They set that up, but he loves to take pictures.
Archer deserved his ass whooping for being a little troll.
Well, it's another round of Scott Bakula wanting Archer to get just the dog shit beat out of him. So he gets beat up by the Corridonite terrorist, then he gets beat up by Jolene Blaylock's massive boobs.
Father, in this and still several episodes to come, they're putting Archer and T'Pol together in these situations again, and you know when the Vulcans show in Fusion, he's the one who's he gets jealous, and so I was like, well, they were clearly wanting to tease that at this point. It's still kind of where they're headed.
It does feel like in these early seasons, the show could never make up their mind if they wanted to pair T'Pol and Archer or T'Pol and Trip. They do eventually make up their mind with Trip. Slight spoilers, but
I knew that.
I'm a fan of that, and I look forward to when we get to those episodes.
It fits that, you know, he was the first person she kind of reached out to a few episodes ago for some advice on her, you know, arranged marriage and stuff like that.
Well, it's because he's the only one who knew about it.
Right, but she, you know, they made that connection.
Yeah, they had that connection kind of forced upon them, but
right. But and I think
sometimes
she was
that's
like,
how sparks form, you know.
And he also, he was extremely, like, he's like, I'm so, so sorry. He's, you know, he was, like, really apologetic and kind of gentlemanly about it, I felt like. But, Father, I gotta tell you, I was really excited in this, just somewhat okay episode when Shran showed up. Because, like, I'm, like, always gonna, I think I'm gonna always want to see more scenes with him.
Yeah.
And I loved that he was, yeah, I see, in the comments, Joel is like, let Shran sleep.
That, that comes off as, like, so dopey and like, kind of weak dialogue to me. Like, it's weird if he's, like, that neurotic, like, he really, like, had to, like, go rescue Archer so he could sleep. I mean, like,
I've got to see more Andorian culture, because right now all I can do is take it at face value, and so I'm like, well, if debt and stuff is that important to them, yeah, maybe that is the way it is. Is it not that important later?
It's never. I that's the only reference I can think of like, you know, like a like an Andorian like an Andorian life debt, you know, kind of being a thing. So it seems to be unique to Shran.
Because yeah, I was like, oh yeah, sure. That's, I'm finding out more about the Andorians.
I almost wish it's like, oh, they had to go to him for help or something like that. Like they had to ask him to, like, hey, you know, we did you a big solid. The least you could do, and like, I kind of would have preferred that if like Trip has to like go to Shran and talk him into helping. But,
yeah.
But that's not what they did. And, you know, it kind of concludes, you know, too quickly when they're having their big shootout, and then they end up shooting a lot of their Coordinite friends, I guess. That guy who
hope it's on stun.
The guy who, oh, that's fair. Yeah. But the guy who tries to shoot Sopek, the Vulcan captain, and then T'Pol, you know, does like the Secret Service slow motion dive, take a bullet for him type thing.
Boom. Little cheesy.
But then Shran just turns around and just unloads on that guy.
He does.
But maybe he was like, no one shoots the Vulcans but me. He's like, no one kills Sopek but me. I've been wanting to assassinate this guy for years. So maybe
You know, he tells the, you know, he dresses down the Vulcan and he's like, you know, it should be you that they were carrying off or whatever. And so, you know, I guess he felt moved to protect her because he saw her do an actual heroic kind of thing and didn't think, probably was like, Vulcans don't do that, but maybe she does.
It was interesting to me that the opening with kind of the tension between Saval and Admiral Forrest talking about how they're super pissed at the humans for exposing their spy station at Pajilm and getting the monastery destroyed. And I don't know, it's just interesting to me, like dealing with bad actors that that want to do very immoral stuff but then try to like hide it behind religion.
Oh, yeah. And I actually like, really
how
like...
dare you attack us and, you know, like our religion and take that approach to it.
I really liked those scenes. I thought the Vulcans were just like very duplicitous in it, and
you see
the
Vulcans being how big of assholes they are in this episode.
Yeah. I like that Forrest pushed back. Yeah. He's like, you don't think you bear some responsibility in this? And by the way, I bet they just freaked when they found out that, like, T'Pol had to, like, turn over the data on that. Because, like, in real life, that almost... I can't really think of a case where that's happened, you know, where... But you do have double agents and stuff like that. But that's probably how they're thinking of her, you know? They're like, a human tells you to hand over all our cool spy information, and you did it. You are going to the gulag.
You're going to Vulcan hell.
Yes.
But they also mentioned Captain Gardner there, and Saval was like, Gardner would have made a better captain. So that's part of, like, I guess why Saval doesn't like Archer. He's pissed off Archer got assigned to Enterprise, not like the guy he wanted. He probably would have been like a better, you know, Vulcan lackey, probably like would have listened to Vulcans more. But
right.
Something I'm trying to focus on is Dave and I are watching Star Trek Enterprise, and you know, we're just getting started with season one here, but I'm trying to look for larger kind of overarching themes throughout the entire series through all four years. And I've never really tried to, you know, look for things that might have been intentional or accidental, but still kind of like work out and to paint like some larger story and where it fits into the tapestry of the Star Trek saga.
Sure.
But something that, like, I'm seeing here is just kind of how manipulative the Vulcans are and how they're so determined to maintain like the status quo of they're kind of the middlemen in power. They're kind of the arbiters of everything. And they're, okay, we have like the Corridan system over here and we're cool with them because they have the really good shipyards and we trade with them. There's some social problems. We don't talk about that. We don't want like the Andorians interfering with that. We sure don't want like the humans, you know, poking their noses around over here, or the humans getting involved with the Andorians. We want to keep them separate over here. So you got to think, like, Archer, he's been hearing, like, all this stuff from the Vulcans, you know, all his life about, like, oh, y'all aren't ready to, like, go out and explore in space and stuff. But then he gets out here and he sees how established the Vulcans are and how they're kind of, like, running the show everywhere, almost kind of, like, passively. Like, we're just here to help. We're just here to advise. It is very imperialistic how, like, a lot of, like, European powers, how, you know, like, you know, people that they couldn't just, they had, like, enough guns they could just, you know, mow down and conquer. They often would do that. But, you know, like, in other cases, you look at, like, the British and Thailand and stuff like that. We're like, oh, we're just going to come in here kind of help and kind of start, you know, like, introducing some of our influence. And then they just never leave. And they just try to maintain control indefinitely. And that's still kind of how, like, the world operates. And it's fun to see.
Power rarely relinquishes itself.
Yeah, I love seeing kind of, like, these fictional politics explored. And I wish that Enterprise, I always talk about this, I said it a lot last week, but I wish that they would have gave Rick and Brandon that year that they asked for. They wanted a year off to kind of develop the show, to build up a writer's room, write a better show Bible, you know, do more world building and kind of lay out the universe a bit more. Because there's, like, a lot of, like, neat stuff that I think is fun to explore, and I just wish that they could have explored. I wish that we had more stuff like that and less, I don't know, like, kind of just bland episodes like Sleeping Dogs.
Right, just sort of episode of the
week.
Yeah,
or flat out, you know, like, bad episodes I don't enjoy. Like, we've had a couple this season, and we're coming up on one in a moment.
But I will say, Father, that this episode also accomplished the thing that I like, which was, you know, that sort of running continuity, straight up the fallout of Pajem. You know, T'Pol was supposed to be recalled for that so she could be punished, and they managed to get around it by the end. But it's, you know, directly influenced by, you know, an episode like five or six episodes before. By the way, that was pretty harsh when T'Pol hears the news and she's like, okay, goodbye. She can, when she's cold, she can be very cold.
There, we do kind of see her, like, warm up a little bit in here when she does kind of show that she does have, like, some fondness for the Enterprise crew. When Archer is like, well, should I turn the shuttle pod around? And she is like, well, we're halfway there, so it would use too much fuel. You know, don't do that. But it's like, oh, no, she still wanted to, like, go along. She's just saying that.
Right.
Or later at the end, when Archer is like, oh, well, I can probably tell Sopek to, you know, beam you up and take you with. And she's like, no, that would violate my doctor's orders if I left. So, but yeah, those are excuses right. That she's making for herself.
Right. It is clear she has formed an attachment. She stayed longer with humans, we find out, than any other Vulcan has, or at least, you know, on board a ship. And so it's you know, it is quite clear. Yeah, she has formed attachments. I feel like in the scene where they're wriggling around in the ropes for like 10 minutes, I feel like they were like creating fetishes in like a generation of kids watching this.
It bothers me that T'Pol can't just, like, stand up. Like, Vulcans are supposed to be so strong, you know? I feel like she would be strong right. enough. She would just be able
they
to stand
did remember,
up.
They did remember that in the episode Fusion, when Archer gets his yeah. butt kicked by a little creeper Vulcan. But, you know, that seems to be the nature of Trek, is when they want a Vulcan to be strong, they do it.
Depends on the ship. Berman Trek, yeah, Berman-era Trek, they couldn't remember Vulcans are stronger.
Right, they're just like, oh, they're intellectuals, they must be little weak dudes. Anything else on this one, Father? Yeah, I did like, I mean, just, you know, 12-year-old Dave, a little bit of that mindset, liked seeing Vulcan commandos yeah. shooting it out with Andorian
commandos. Vulcan and
commandos.
Andorian commandos are cool. Yeah, that was fun.
Just, yeah, just some raw, cool action-y stuff in it. But yeah, it's the episode could have used some more, you know, like another pass or two or something like that.
Yeah. Let's move on to our next episode. We got three more to cover. The next one, Shuttle Pod 1, written by Rick Berman and Brandon Braga, directed by David Livingston. While investigating an asteroid field, Tucker and Reed are convinced the Enterprise has been destroyed and try not to face their own oncoming deaths. This kind of seems to be either like a, I don't know, either people love it or hate it with this one. I've heard a lot of people express both, but how do you feel about it?
Yeah, I was looking at our comments and I saw some hate floating up for it. I have one very big, like, plot thing, like, maybe, I don't know if I missed something, but I wasn't sure why they were so convinced that Enterprise had been destroyed when it seemed like there was only a bit of junk that was stuck in that asteroid and not like a massive debris field.
I think that's dumb too, but I'm in the hate camp. I am not a fan of Shuttle Pod 1. I think this is a very bad episode in my opinion.
Once it gets going, I like the episode. It's a little bit one note as far as trying to, you know, early on they frame it like, oh, they're stuck in this thing. They have diminishing supplies. They're not going to, there's no way they'll ever get anywhere, or there's no way they'll ever get found. And, Reed is the pessimist who thinks they're going to die. Trip is the guy who wants to try and keep every little thing they can do to keep going. So he's the optimist. But I thought it brought out some stuff in Reed that gave me some insight into his character, that he is a guy who's never quite found his place. He doesn't quite interact well with women, even though he's had lots of girlfriends.
That's what I don't get. Yeah, that seems so inconsistent. It's like he's banged every waitress in San Francisco, but he sucks with women.
And he's never created a relationship and an emotional attachment. You know, you could probably dive into like various things that could be going on with that. But, you know, that can happen. You know, it doesn't mean that you're capable of, like, a mature relationship just because you can bang stuff. So I also thought it was interesting that he was, like, he's creating these messages that are like, oh, I wanted to let you know I still think about you. Like, it's kind of lightweight, you know. Even Tripp says, you know, you're basically giving the same message to all these girls, just that you think about them sometimes. But I think we hear a snippet of one where it seems like he was messaging his parents and saying, oh, yeah, Archer told me you didn't even know what my job was. He's like, I find that hard to believe.
They didn't know what – they told him that they didn't know what ship he was on. But they told Hoshi, they were like, oh, he called and told us he got assigned to Enterprise. So I didn't really get I think that was just like Rick and Brandon forgot what they had in that episode. But
I mean, maybe. But like, I think the – it looked like he was starting to address it. I felt really bad for him because Trip is like – he's kind of just like, you're yapping and I'm just trying to sleep. And he's actually trying to process something that he clearly always suppresses, you know, that he's always kind of the dutiful son. Mm-hmm. And but they don't really seem to care about him that much because he went Starfleet and not like naval ocean water.
But even,
you know,
I don't really like that background. That also seems just so trite. And just, it was more of what I was saying before. And I feel like they didn't really think out his character. They're just like, we just want like stuffy British guy. Well, I do like overall. I kind of like dislike this episode. There are things in it I appreciate in it, like Connor Trinneer and Dominic Keating's acting. I think that they're pretty good. And I was surprised when I saw them do kind of a cold reading of the script where they just read all the shuttle pod scenes, just the two of them on their YouTube channel. I actually got like really invested in listening to that. And I think my problem with this is just the execution of it. We've seen way too many Star Trek episodes, just TV stories in general, of two characters trapped in a room together. It's like that in its of itself just reeks of triteness. Like, do something to make it fresh. At least give me like some good dialogue. Like get like a guy who can write like some good dialogue, like Joss Whedon or Quentin Tarantino or someone like that to do a pass on this. But no, it was Rick Berman and Brandon Brown. And it was just, I don't know, it's just very dry, just very, it's just like the snails on a turtle thing when it's like, we'll be so slow, we'll be moving along at a snail's pace. And what about like two snails riding on a turtle? Like, hold on, Fred. I don't know, this seems very like uncreative.
I thought that was fun.
It just seems uncreative. It just seems like the first thing you would think of.
I mean, I don't know that I would immediately go to the snails on a turtle thing. Sometimes Star Trek slightly shotguns its information through, you know, I always thought they shotgunned, you know, Geordi, the awkward, you know, can't get a date guy. And I think sometimes they somewhat shotgunned Data's, you know, I just can't fit in, you know, stuff.
I guess I also don't really like the friendship between Reed and Trip, just because I don't think that they're, like, that interesting of characters. It's just, like, the good old boy from the Florida Panhandle who wants to be an engineer is, like, kind of cool. Or I guess he is an engineer, not, like, wants to be. And then, I don't know, like, really stuffy British dude who's like all like proper and wants to be like good soldier boy and is all about like duty but I guess we get like, you know, the additional dimension of he has a hard time connecting with people, but it's all like tell and not show. Like, you haven't really like shown me much of him, you know, like forming bonds and friendships and connections he's never formed before in his life. You just kind of tell me that that's happened. And I want to complain about the dream scene where it's just, it's like, that also feels so like uninspired to me. It's like, oh, he has a dream that they wake up back on sickbay and they're safe and he doesn't know it's a dream. But then, you know, Jolene walks over to him and does like some real sexy stuff. And I don't know, laughs at some dumb joke. Oh, he says the word stinky, you know, we're not actually like funny or clever people. So we're not going to write a good joke here.
That was pretty bad. That yeah. part was pretty bad.
So it's just, I don't know. Yeah. It's like cringy to watch. It's just like, I do kind of feel sorry for him, you know, like, oh, did you really have to like wake him up? You know, like when Trip was like, who is Stinky? And then he's just like, oh, I guess it was all a dream. You know, I kind of do feel sorry for him, but I like that they mentioned the waitress Ruby at the 602 Club. We actually meet her in season two. There's a flashback to some San Francisco 602 Club stuff.
Interesting.
But I like some of the scenes of when Reed does like convince Trip, when like the roles are reversed and then Reed becomes the optimist for a moment and Trip puts the candle out and he's like, oh, I guess like we need like, you know, the few extra hours after all, doesn't sound that bad. And it turns out like they only had 2 or 3 hours of air left. So they really did like everything that they did, like kind of save air. Like, yeah, it was a good thing you did that or you would be dead. But I agree with you, like your criticism of like, it's weird that they're like so convinced of the ship's destruction at the beginning. And that always like looked awkward to me as well. And it's that kind of annoying frustration sometimes people get when the audience knows something that the characters don't, and when it makes like the characters seem right. seem kind of like bumbling, like why don't you, no, like Enterprise is fine, like they're out there, like
if they had like done a little bit more, some kind of techno babble, something that made it look more like a debris field, some other ship had been destroyed, and you know, to their damaged sensors, they're like, that has to be the Enterprise. There's a few actual parts of Enterprise. Like, you could have sold me on it a little bit better without having to go too much farther.
And then some of like the drunken dialogue, I think some of that goes on too long. Like Dominic and Connor sell it at first, but then like it just when it starts getting like silly during stuff that should be serious, where it's like, well, if it's not nothing, then it has to be something. It's just, I don't know. It's just
part of the reason I enjoyed some of that stuff is because I like when actors kind of get to act out of their normal stuff, you know. If they get to be drunk, they get to be cold and show that they're physically uncomfortable in this. You know, they get to yell at each other. They don't normally get to do that. They can kind of really go off.
Cake is Eternal and the live audience is saying, seems like they'd be able to find out how much debris there was and it wasn't enough to be Enterprise. But I think I found a fix for this. That their whole reason why they turned around and came back is their sensor array wasn't working. So maybe they can't scan. So maybe that's why they were limited, and just the visuals, just what they could see from the hatch looked like the ship was destroyed and they couldn't scan for more debris. I guess that's what happened.
They did, you know, they didn't like at length discuss, I can't believe, you know, the ship is destroyed. There's just, you know, how could it have happened? The only thing is at some point they're like, you know, oh, you know, how old were Hoshi and Mayweather? You know, no more than like 23, I bet, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so that was them reflecting on it. But most of the stuff was focused on survival or, you know, just kind of putting one foot in front of the other. So I guess to their credit, they didn't talk, you know, endlessly about it. They just did the best thing that they could in their situation was start heading towards something. But, Father, I will come down as someone who likes this episode all right.
Yeah, that's interesting. I said it was like, I feel like people either love it or hate it, and then you proved me wrong. But that's cool. I'd be curious how other people feel about it as well. Joel in our live audience said it was good, cold representation, so I'm sure he's freezing his ass off in Minneapolis right now.
But I don't think I think the one thing that no one will champion is the stinky sequence.
Yeah.
God, you know, like, the basic idea that, you know, he imagines some scenario where he makes T'Pol laugh and she kind of opens up to him, that's a good concept, but man, the dialogue has to sell it.
Oh, I guess, like, one last thing to mention is this does kind of cement the Reed Trip friendship, and so from the rest of the show on, they're kind of like real good buddies. And I don't know, I think it's kind of a boring friendship. It's just like at least like Data and Geordi, it was like, oh, but there's like an android and like this blind dude. It's like that was just more neat to me. But whatever, they're your basic dude bro BFFs.
It's not gonna reach O'Brien and Bashir levels.
It doesn't even reach Tom and Harry levels, but that's okay. That's okay. We'll move on to Fusion. I got some Vulcan action. Teleplay by Phyllis Strong and Mike Sussman. Story by Rick Berman and Brandon Braga. Directed by Rob Hedden. The crew of Enterprise meets a group of outcast Vulcans who embrace their own emotions, leading to trouble for T'Pol. So the cult of hippie Vulcans that are, they embrace their emotions. They try to do both. They're like, oh, we do logic and emotions both. They're called the Vatosh Couture. They seem to be kind of based on Cybok from Star Trek V, and we later learn in Strange New Worlds, Cybok is classified as a Vatosh Couture, so it all ties together. But, David, I know that this is an episode that you do remember well, that we talk about frequently on the show. We mention it all the time. But let's talk about it in greater detail than ever before. Tell us more about how you feel about Fusion.
Right, so just, plot-wise, they bring over these Vulcans to... Are they... helping, what is it that leads them to interact with these Vulcans? They're helping them repair something?
The Vulcans asked for help with repairs, and then kind of in return, I guess, they were helping Enterprise scan the nearby nebula.
The nebula thing, right. And so, yeah, we kind of get two Vulcans, primarily, is it Kov, who's
three. There's three named Vulcans. There's the... Kov is kind of, he's kind of like Vulcan Veer, if anyone knows Veer from Babylon 5.
Yeah, a little bit of a doofus.
And then there's Captain Tavin, who's played by Robert Pine. So Chris Pine, Kelvin Kirk's dad, Robert Pine, plays this Vulcan captain. And then we have creepy, rapey dude.
Yeah.
Valaris, right?
Talaris. Yeah.
Oh, sorry, with a T, not a V. Talaris, yeah.
So, you know, when I'm watching this episode, I was like, man, I feel like they had to walk some lines on the episode. They needed to depict Vulcan sort of radicals, and they needed to decide on whether we're going to judge, oh, are they superior to Vulcans or inferior to traditional Vulcans? And, like, early on, they're like, oh, they seem superior. They're more chill, but they seem to have the qualities of Vulcans and their logic when they need to. And, you know, we have to kind of base it mostly on Kov and Talaris' story. And I think they walked that line pretty well by showing, you know, that... Kov is kind of capable of growth and maturity, but Talaris is an example where abandoning the Vulcan philosophy kind of went wrong.
That's a good point, yeah. It's a case-by-case thing.
And then there's a trickier thing about it. There's a sexual assault in this episode, and, you know, I feel like time has to judge that one, that this is probably something more that women can judge than I can. But I felt like they did a pretty good job up until maybe a little bit of stuff at the end, like... It shows how from the outside you could think, oh yeah, T'Pol is mainly engaging with this guy, and she wants to, you know, a part of her wants to break free, but he has also been kind of quietly coercing her and manipulating her, and then obviously when she says no, man, he doesn't stop, and he's, you know, then he's revealed as the kind of creepy rapist he is. I thought at the very end. It ceases a little bit to be her story, and we see kind of Archer defend her.
Oh yeah, he becomes a white knight, doesn't he? I never lensed it that way, but you're right. Yeah, that's a problem. Yeah.
And also, although I kind of get why, it's like they just are like, well, you better get out of here, you. And that actually sort of feels somewhat bitterly realistic. Like, well, what are we going to do? Prosecute these Vulcans that we have no jurisdiction over for it, you know.
It's sadly, strangely realistic how there's
it is weirdly realistic.
I hate like saying these words out loud, but yeah, I mean, I guess like people get assaulted like that, and there is no recourse, and it's just the universe just expects you to just I guess this is life as normal, like unless people, it takes action to prevent that from being the reality, you know, so.
I overall think this is a well-written episode. I think they stage it pretty much as well as you could in the early 2000s, and...
I don't know if that's what they wanted the episode to be about, you know, I kind of think it might have just been, it started off as the idea of, like, exploring these different types of Vulcans, and then that they might have just added that as, you know, we need something that's like a big dramatic, you know, climax or event, you know, in the third act, but...
I feel like they wanted to, you know... have two stories going on, really, that Talaris and Kov, and to, you know, have Kov be the guy who is actually ultimately pretty, he does handle their philosophy well, the Vatosh Couture, And Talaris is clearly been suppressing or like hiding his anger, and he's that creepy little half smile he's got a whole lot. I feel like I'm looking at like Andrew Tate of Vulcan.
There's a lot of good stuff in this episode, just in terms of like quality, in terms of like how well done it was. Like,
yeah,
he seems very realistic. Like, there are like a lot of like creepy dudes who are like, just the scene where he's in the mess hall with T'Pol and he's asking her for some tea or something, and like she's trying to like help him, but how like he doesn't like move to like get out of her way when she's reaching for stuff. Like, he's trying to like force her to like stand close to him, and then like when she goes over to like pour the drink or whatever, like he goes and like steps closer to her. Like, he's always like staying close. It's like weird, like creepy stuff, like real, very real life behaviors that, like, you, I'm sure like women can testify to this stuff more than we can. And they also do a good job of making them seem like atypical Vulcans, but they still have a layer of Vulcanness that comes through. And I know, like, they made like the Vulcan actors on Enterprise, like everyone had to go to like Vulcan school, learn how to Vulcan. And they do a really good job, you know, for Berman Trek, as much as it kind of stayed away from Vulcans. I think a lot of people have problems with how assholes the Vulcans are in Enterprise, but that was a very intentional choice. And I don't even think it's necessarily a bad choice. We'll talk more about the Vulcans arc when we get to some season four stuff. But the Vulcans, as far as like, I don't know how they behave, they always seem like, you know, kind of that TOS flavor of Vulcanness that Leonard Nimoy invented, that most Vulcan actors have been able to tap into over the years. I think Star Trek's been pretty consistent and good with Vulcans most of the time.
Nimoy created an amazing model.
Yeah.
To a
great
up
template.
On.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I've much else. I guess like this episode kind of, it was important and helping me realize how, like, I don't really like jazz music. This is the music that plays in, like, the nightmare scene in here.
Yeah.
Like, that's some of, like, the worst. Like, I don't know whatever that saxophone was doing, but I hate that more than Faith of the Heart. Like, that's my actual least favorite piece of Star Trek music.
It's also supposed to be chaotic and anarchic, and, but...
I hear that, and, like, I know, like, as a big metalhead, like, some people, like, can't stand extreme rock music, and to them it sounds like that. And I don't know, to me, like, it sounds like if I just, like, went in my kitchen drawer over here and pulled out a knife and just started like stabbing myself in the ear repeatedly with it is what it sounds like to me. But yeah, I don't have anything else on Fusion.
You know, the one thing I kind of want to mention in there is just that I was glad that, like, T'Pol immediately did call sick bay after the sort of mental assault. They showed that was giving her, I think, some agency in the moment.
It is very
least.
Uncomfortable to watch. Like,
it is. And, you know, I don't know that there's a comfortable way that can be depicted with any accuracy. To some degree, I kind of don't want it showing up too often in Trek in general. But, you know, this is an aspect of life and should be in some way acknowledged. Sometimes it can be done with metaphor. It doesn't necessarily have to be a literal thing. This kind of did that. It's a, you know, mental assault. And that kind of gave them a little bit, I think it made it seem somehow a little less heinous. But when we're watching it and we see a character we care about under that level of duress, well, then it is or super horrible. I need to find out someday that Talaris gets, you know, blown up by somebody. And I know that's me white knighting it, like, just like Archer, but, you know, I'm just saying I wouldn't mind if somebody just wrote that into some story.
Well, instead he smacks around.
Like, Kov spaced it.
That was what was going to happen, and then Scott Bakula saw the script and was like, I think this guy would beat up Archer. I want Archer to get smacked around. So they did that instead. Let's move on to the last episode we're going to discuss tonight, Rogue Planet. Teleplay by Chris Black. Story by guess who? Guess the two dudes who have the story by credit. It's Rick Berman and Brandon Braga, but also Chris Black, directed by Alan Craker. So, man, those dudes. When we finish season one next week, we'll come up with a tally of how many episodes they wrote. This was a, talk about year of hell and Voyager. This was a year of hell for them.
You know, I think I need to see which ones they wrote, because I know there's
it's a mixed bag. Yeah, the stuff that they wrote.
There's stuff in it that I definitely like, and I thought had some nuance. There's something in this. This is kind of a lower tier one for me, but there's a few bits that I really enjoy in it. Including the premise, just that there's, I like the idea of these weird, you know, kind of, it's almost sad and lonely, like the loneliest thing, the idea of a planet that doesn't have a planetary system, that is just drifting through space, endlessly cold. And yet this one is kind of unique because it's got like the thermal vents from inside it that create I guess, luckily, a very Earth-like atmosphere, as well as, you know, harboring, you know, allowing plant life and animal life to still continue.
The synopsis on it, Archer has visions of a mysterious humanoid woman on a rogue planet where it is eternally nighttime. They meet, like, these cool hunters, so it's like another, it was two, or I thought they were cool at least, like, at first, there were two episodes back-to-back where we meet, like, a crew of people, and like, oh, they seem like some decent dudes, I'll hang out with them for a little bit, they seem cool, and then, oh, it turns out, like, they're kind of assholes, or at least some of them are, with the Vulcans. I guess, like, all these guys suck, they're murdering these intelligent beings, if they were just, you know, if they just came to this planet to, like, shoot hogs in camp...
Yeah.
You know, they wouldn't be, I was like, oh yeah, let's like go camp with them. That'd be fine. But yeah, it turns out that they are, they're doing some pretty messed up stuff. So.
Yeah. Archer does like, you know, throws him a bone and he kind of says, yeah, we don't really hunt anymore on Earth. But he's like, we respect your traditions and, you know, nobody like hurled the food to the ground or anything like that. But yeah, it's the kind of the trophy hunting nature, that they lied about the sentient stuff. Yeah. About it too.
I like the casting in this episode. I agree with you. Like the rogue planet is neat. The idea of like, yes, it's permanently dark. So it's always like these dark forests and you know these dark, dangerous jungles. And it sounds like really like deadly hunting ground that would be kind of exciting and enticing. But the casting is also something that stands out to me. The Wraith Lady when like. Archer kisses the woman and she turns into a slug. It's kind of like when he kissed Saren, that Suliban woman, and then she morphed. But I want him to be like...
That doesn't normally happen.
I mean, it seems to keep happening with them now. So, but yeah. That woman is the same actor who played the Trill who gives Riker the sexy eyes when he handles the manual steering column in Star Trek Insurrection. So they bring her back for that. But more importantly, the guy who plays... Like the Eska, I don't know, captain, the lead hunter.
Yeah.
He has a really hard name to say, but he's in like so many things I love. He plays Holtz and an Angel, if anyone likes Buffy or Angel. He was one of the cops in The Dark Knight. He like beats up Heath Ledger's Joker. He's Mr. Freeze in Young Justice. He does a lot of voice acting, but he's in Babylon 5. Yeah, he pops up in like so much cool stuff. But there's not like a ton of substance in this. I don't know. It's kind of a neat sci-fi idea. It's a very like Bran and Braga idea, like the idea of like these wraiths and they look like these big slugs, but they'll turn into like a beautiful woman from the poem you heard about Fisherman or something as a kid. Yeah. I don't. Do you know?
I actually really liked that.
The Song of the Wandering Angus or whatever. I don't know what that is, but
yeah, I'm gonna look into it because I really like that idea. It's just one of those things that kind of I think somewhat separates Trek from the other Star franchise, which is that you might have an alien shape changer who's the beautiful woman she turns into is based on your kind of like perfect childhood vision, you know, of what a pretty woman would be. And from a poem your mother told you to comfort you. I'm like, that's a cool and neat idea. It's something a little, something very different.
Dave, there's an episode of Lower Decks that shows one of the the Federation outpost scientists that are always doing the experiments or whatever on other planets. Mm-hmm. But there's one of them studying the rocks on this planet, and he sees like the vision of his seventh grade geology teacher. It was kind of like his dream girl. You get the idea. That was like the woman of his dreams. But, you know, he grew up to be, like, he's studying rocks on an alien planet. So, of course, when he was in seventh grade, he had a crush on his geology teacher. So, but, yeah, kind of similar to this. I didn't really draw that connection until now. But, yeah, I mean, I don't know. There's not, like, really a ton. I like Reed had more. I like that Reed and Archer were both scouts and that Reed had more merit badges. I guess, like, the Eagle Scouts is just, like, global and, like, the more, like, Earth United of the 22nd century. Because right now, like, they don't have Eagle Scouts in the UK. They have, like, what are the King Scouts or whatever they are. They have their own thing. They have their own Boy Scout thing there. But I guess in the future, we'll all be united after World War III.
Eagle Scouts take over all other scouting
We don't really know who wins World War III, so maybe it's the Scouts they win, you know?
I just want to, I would compliment, I think, some of the writing and the portrayal of the hunting group. They kind of have, early on, it's just kind of like a fairly friendly bro-ish vibe, but later on, it's kind of like they're always sharing a slightly dark private joke, and they're, you know, they have this little cruelty that starts to fit in there, they start chiding the captain about his visions, and that you kind of get this harsher view of them, even as, we're about to start learning that they are not these kind of chill dudes that Malcolm should go off and hunt with. But I thought they portrayed that pretty well. They started to become intimidating to me as I watched it.
I guess it is kind of an easy solution when Archer is just like, oh, Phlox, can you whip up something to fix this? And Phlox is like, sure, yeah, they'll never be able to detect these things again. So
yeah, very specific, but, you know, I do kind of enjoy this, you know, this is a... You know, they're far from the first person that's done this. The, oh, we're in over our heads. The animals around us are all growling. And now we, the hunters have become the hunted. The, you know, not an original concept, but, you know, I enjoyed it. I can enjoy a little bit of payback to people who are cruel and monstrous people.
It'd be fun if, like, the wraiths, if they had the ability to, like, oh, now we're going to become, like, the things of your nightmares and scare you. We're not going to hurt you because we're not assholes like you. We're just going to scare the ever-loving dog shit out of you and make sure that you never come back to this planet. That would have been cool to kind of turn it into, like, a haunted house planet, you know, and just make them see all kinds of weird trippy
stuff. Well, you know, if it would be interesting if Archer had to suggest that. They're like, oh, you know, we only ever... choose, you know, we only choose things that people like, that, you know, it's not in our nature to do that. And he's like, oh, I'm going to teach you how to do, show them cruel visions and then you'll be safe. But it's like, oh, but I've had to teach them how to do something that's really kind of creepy. And then there will be fallout to that later on. But,
if he ever wants to see the girl of his dreams again, I guess he can come back to this rogue planet and kiss the slug again.
Yeah. Would he be willing to say, like, just go ahead and keep that form for a little while?
It's... Mind out of the gutter, Dave.
You know, it's like, what's his name in The Matrix?
They didn't have holodecks yet. They didn't have holodeck technology yet, so.
Now, wait, is it just an illusion, or does it actually become that?
No, I guess it actually becomes it. Yeah, this
it actually becomes it. That's what I'm saying. Because,
like, Phlox was like, yeah, like, this organic tissue is trying to morph into something else. So, yeah.
You got to be like Cypher and be like, you know, the steak tastes good.
Yeah, sometimes you just got to play along with the illusion, I guess. Just go along with it and enjoy the ride. But I hope everyone enjoyed the ride of season one so far. I guess we're 2/3 of the way into it, but we got 8 more season one episodes to cover. So Dave and I will talk about those next week when we cover everything from episode 19, Acquisition, up to the season one finale, Shockwave. So we're going to have Jeffrey Combs come back, but not as Shran. We're going to have some Ferengi, however you feel about them being in the 22nd century. Clancy Brown, another fun guest star, will show up. We have a vacay to Ryza, so everyone loves Ryza, right? And some timey-wimey stuff going on, temporal Cold War stuff going on with a big finale. So all of that stuff to talk about next week. Please come back and join us then. But... until that time, as always, live long and prosper, y'all.
Listen to the Text Trek podcast through Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or at text-trek.com. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/text-trek. And follow Fathery on Twitter at TXTrek. Please support us by liking our videos and subscribing to our channel on YouTube. Thank you and take care.